And now you just actually you raised an interesting question that that I should pose to you. Since you were friends with Hynek, and he was sort of closely affiliated with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and there's always sort of talk about Spielberg either knowing more about UFOs than he lets on or being used as a conduit for disclosure. Did Hynek have any thoughts on Spielberg and the film and whether or not it was being used as like a re-educational tool for the mass public?
No, he never actually mentioned that. I did research on that later on. I did, in my book, I talk about that. Steven Spielberg belonged to a group of people that would meet at Francis Ford Coppola's house. And, you know, those people who was involved there were the people in the 70s who were in California. And Uri Geller was there, I guess, and Jack Sarfati was there, and what's his name, Jacques Vallée was there, and Spielberg was there, and they all got to talking. I mean, I think they all had some idea about this. And then I think that Spielberg, on another level, realized when he was speaking to Jacques Vallée and Alan Hynek that these files they had at CUFOS, a lot of them were real. And the contact, and if you look at the movie, the little boy was contacted and all these people were contacted telepathically to be at a certain spot.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that there wasn't some kind of landing. And I'm not sure that they weren't all contacted telepathically. And I think that, you know, I'm not surprised if you study this, the literature, and you study a lot of this, that, you know, the meeting with the aliens at Muroc with Eisenhower didn't really happen. I mean, it's logical. It's a national security issue. A lot of this stuff, you know, I think if you study it, you realize that a lot of people have done a lot of hard work to try to put together this puzzle.
Yeah.
And I think that it's logic. I mean, of course, you know, we're dealing with contact, and I think that even though it's glamorized, you know, I think that Close Encounters is about a landing and about an invitation. And I remember Jacques Truffaut saying about the contactees, these people have been invited telepathically, and it's been very, and it's real interesting. I think that's a possible scenario.
Do you think disclosure, if it happens, would start outside of the U.S. and then gain speed and then sort of become like an accepted fact in America, or do you think it's going to happen in America first?
No, it's going to start out of the U.S. I think we're all agreeing to that. I mean, when I went to interview Paul Hellyer, he was hoping, he said, you know, he admired Stephen Greer's work, and he said that something like the Disclosure Project, and that was amazing. That was all these military people, including Robert Salas, who was the military man that was in the bunker, you know, that talked about the missiles being shut down in Maelstrom. And that's a real event. Those were real UFOs, and those missiles were really shut down. And Stephen put all those people together in the Washington Press Club. And if it's not going to happen there, if it's not going to happen with real credible witnesses, these aren't contactees, or, you know, these are military people, military intelligence people that were involved. Even though the context scenario is very important, those poor people have been, you know, not taken as seriously as the military people. I think they should all come together, all of them. And I was talking to Paul Hellyer about this, and he said, well, maybe we should try this in Canada or should try it somewhere else. But then, you know, they did try it in Canada. As you know, May 9th of this year, from my website, Stephen Greer brought the whole Disclosure Project film video, and with Paul Hellyer, they did a conference in Canada, and no media showed up. So what does that tell you? What does that tell you? The media is opted out of this subject matter.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so one of the problems is that until the time is right and they get an okay, that's not going to happen in this hemisphere. What might happen is if Mexico keeps going, because they're having the most sightings right now, and if there's any big event in Europe and that's publicized and taken seriously, then it's going to come out from outside. It probably will come from outside.
And do you think it'll just start like a domino effect where one country where it'll be forced out in one country and then, you know, the next country, and then sort of it'll just keep spreading until finally in the U.S. they're forced to do something about it or say something about it?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't think they'll ever do it. I don't think that anybody will be forced to. I think the people will, when the people decide that they really want to know something, they can change the whole because it can change everything.
Yeah.
When people decide, hey, you know, I'm not going to spend billions and billions of dollars on you know, fighting aliens in space, or, you know, on weapons in space or whatever. When people decide, you know, it has to be the mass, the mass consciousness, and when they decide, then it'll change. It has nothing to do with the people in power, because I don't even think they know. I mean, I don't think, like Stephen Greer says, he had to brief three-quarters of the people in Washington. They don't know. They've got other things on their plate. They've got a war. They've got other things they're worried about. This is the last thing they're worried about. and so it has to be an intellectual wanting to know. In other words, I'm convinced that the average person that goes to the grocery store, that watches the game, that has a couple of beers, doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Because if they cared, they would bother to study this, and they'd know. But I mean, until the consciousness of the people are wanting to know and not being afraid to know changes, then nothing's going to happen. Because I don't think that the politicians know. I don't think the government, national. This is so compartmentalized, and it's such a secret that I don't think that, you know, those guys that are working on all that are never going to come out with it. I think that the people are the ones that are going to have to make the decision. And maybe it's another generation, Tim. Maybe it's going to be the younger generation. Maybe the younger generation is going to say, hey, listen, if there's beings that are visiting, and it's not all grays, let's get off of that, visiting us, and they're watching our development, and they're watching where they're going to make it or break it in this historical period, we want to know who those beings are. When that happens, then we'll know.
Yeah. And for lack of a better expression, how do you think that will go down? I mean, because like you said, you don't think the government's going to make an announcement, but we do need this, like, paradigm shift where we're going to just openly accept that UFOs are real and that ETs exist and that they're visiting here. How do you see that sort of transition playing out?
That's exactly what John Mack wanted. John Mack stood on a stage in Florence and said, we can become part of cosmic culture, of the cosmos. We can take our place in the universe if we have a new world view. And he called it a new world view. He didn't use the word paradigm shift, because
yeah.
I think that's been used by New Age situation. He said new world view. And he said when that happens, we will no longer be the virus of the universe, because what we have to give, what we have to offer other cultures, and if we look at it that they might have culture, you know, what we have to offer them is nuclear bombing and wars and, you know, all this stuff, you know, where we, commercialization, we have that to offer them? No, I mean, we basically need to change the whole new world view of who we are as a species. And John Mack was very clear about that. He said, when we have this new world view, we will be able to come into our own, to graduate where we deserve to be part of a cosmic situation. And that's a very beautiful part. If you look at it, and somebody does a studying on Gene Roddenberry, the Star Trek ideal of the Federation being part of many, many, many cultures is the most ideal. And I think that's the one the young people can swallow the best.
Yeah.
Because that's the one that fits. I mean, that's logical. But until we stop fighting among ourselves, I don't think we can even look at aliens. I mean, aliens are so different from us in the way they think, the way they operate, the way they look. I mean, can you imagine trying to be part of that when we can't even be part of what we got here?
Yeah. So does that make you less or more optimistic about seeing disclosure happen in your lifetime?
Well, it all depends. You know, I'm going, well, is it in our hands? Well, okay, well, if it's in our hands, if this is in our hands, then okay, I'm going to keep trying on a university level, trying to look at all the literature, all the artwork. Remember, I told you Renaissance art, all kinds of stuff that's out there. I'll do my best as a professor or as a teacher. But if it's on their scale, if they're going to do, I mean, you don't know what they got in mind.
Yeah.
Suppose they do a Mexico City flyover of here with 200 UFOs. I mean, if it's in their hands, then we don't have a choice. Everybody's looking at them, and there they are, and, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to explain that to anybody? It depends on whose hands this agenda is in. If it's in our hands, I'm just going to do the scholarly thing. If it's in their hands, it's going to be really interesting how people react to that.
Yeah, that's for sure. And based on what you think and what you've researched, whose hands do you think it's in, us or theirs, or do you just not know yet?
Well, I think the minute we start thinking of destroying ourselves with the nuclear energy, you're going to see mass sightings all over the world. The minute somebody gets an idea to destroy this planet, or the minute some rogue nation or anything happens where they're going to be doing any kind of nuclear bombing that's going to kill millions and millions of people, I think you're going to have mass sightings. I think the prime directive is to let us alone till we get to that point.
Yeah.
I think the prime directive is, okay, well, let these guys kill each other until they start to do something. Because from what I understand and from the studies I've done, the use of the nuclear powers, because these things appear over nuclear bases that have nuclear power, even Colonel Corso said, where there are nuclear rockets and where nuclear, because the nuclear, for some reason, goes into their dimension and messes up their stuff. Mm-hmm. It messes up their stuff so badly that they don't like that we're messing. It's like we've got these dangerous toys.
Yeah.
The minute that we start doing something with these dangerous toys is the minute you're going to see that the agenda may be in their hands.
Yeah. And that might just test the ball rolling and takes it out of the Earthlings' hands, pretty much.
Well, that's logical. We don't know what we're doing, and we're causing problems other places. I mean, with this, and it's really interesting because Jesse Marcel, when I was talking to him, he said, hopefully they have surpassed that part in their history, and we will survive. He said that we won't have to go through that part of history where we self-destruct this planet. I mean, right now, people aren't even understanding how serious the Middle East situation is. That is darn serious, more serious than I've ever seen, ever. So, I mean, that this situation there, unless it gets solved, if it escalates, it's going to be mess. And I think that whoever's watching the planet is watching that for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they're watching that because that is a situation that can have its repercussions every which way.
Mm-hmm. The human race, it doesn't seem like it's really ready to be integrated into any sort of galactic community at all. How do you think that would play out if we force the hand of the ETs, but we're really not even mature enough to handle what we're forcing them to do? Do you think that'll cause some kind of panic, or do you think that people will be okay already? Will they be like, well, we knew it all along anyway, type of situation?
No, I think it'll be a tremendous shock. I mean, it's like when the New World was discovered, you know, and the Europeans came here and the Native Americans saw them. And it's culture. It's when cosmic cultures meet. I mean, they didn't know what to make of these people. And they looked at them like gods. And then there was this clash of cultures. I think that same thing is going to happen. I'm hoping that religions won't be created around aliens, and we won't be looking at them like gods and all this other kind of stuff. I'm hoping that'll never happen.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that intelligent, scholarly, studious people come forth and try to communicate. And there we go again. If they're communicating with telepathy, then I think that a lot of people should start looking at the use of telepathy or the use of these things that they call the paranormal, ESP, remote viewing, and all this. I mean, it's very important that we be using every method of communication other than a radio. What do you call it? A radio telescope?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you're using a radio telescope. These things communicate telepathically. You know, I'm hoping that people will get into that. I mean, into looking at it in a very broad way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like you said, it's hard to a lot of people try and put the UFO phenomenon into our field of science instead of expanding the science.
Yeah, well, see, this is where Colonel Corso said, you know, if we could invent a new science around this, I mean, if you could look at all of this and just rewrite it all, like we have to rewrite our history, then they will come across the answer. He was all for the new science.
Yeah.
That he was all for that. And you know, out there, I think there are people that are doing this, and I think there are people that are on the bandwagon and people taking it seriously. It's just that you don't find out about it, and you just don't know about it. You know, that's one of the reasons I like exopolitics, because basically it's a studious. You read everybody's papers, and you read everybody's books, and you kind of put it together.
Yeah, yeah. Instead of being like one niche area of the science, where you're sort of
right.
Like isolated from all the other stuff that's going on. I want to talk to you a little bit about Paul Hellyer. He's sort of like the big story of the past year in ufology and exopolitics. What did you take away from your discussion with Paul Hellyer?
Well, on a really personal level, I was shocked that he would talk to me about UFOs. I mean, I looked at him, and when he said to me that he had read Colonel Corso's book, and he had checked on Corso with a four-star general, and that Corso was telling the truth, and he had gone on about not spending money to blow aliens out of the sky. I looked at him and I said, "Do you know what you're saying? You're using the word UFOs and aliens." I said, "Do you know how unpopular that is?" I was told by scientists it's the kiss of death to talk about this subject matter if you're a serious scientist or a serious politician. And he made me really. You know, he put it right there. He said, "Paula, in the good book, in the Bible, it says the truth shall set you free." He said, "I'm not about to talk about lies." You know, and so, I mean, he really brought me down, because I was, you know, kind of warning him about what he was saying. And he threw it back at me, and he said, "Why don't you stay with looking for the truth?" Which really taught me a lesson. And what he talked about in detail in my interview was that basically that this planet is run on an economic structure, and that the economic structure is extremely detrimental to the evolution of mankind.
Yeah.
And so he had written six books on economics, and one of them is called The Evil Empire. I didn't realize it because, you know, I did all my homework, my research before I walked into his office.
Mm-hmm.
And he believes that the fossil fuel, the oil, the big banks and the whole group of people that make all the decisions are running the whole thing, including the whole UFO thing. And I don't do conspiracy theory. I don't like getting into it, even though I interviewed David Icke and I interviewed the people who talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like talking about it because, and I'll give you the reason, Tim, is because it doesn't do any good. I mean, big deal. So, I mean, we all know there's conspiracy theory. We all know that everything isn't the way it really seems. Like, what good does it do to really harp on that? I'd rather go and talk about positive things, like, you know, our ability to use meditation and good intentions to change the world. I mean, I'd rather look at a Gandhi or a situation, you know, with compassion and love that would change the world than to talk about all the conspiracy stuff.
Yeah.
So I can honestly say that Paul Hellyer is real knowledgeable about how the world is run, and he wants to contribute some little part to the talking about possibly becoming cosmic culture. And he, like Edgar Mitchell, who's another wonderful, wonderful interview that I did. Edgar Mitchell also wants, he's an Apollo 14 astronaut who walked on the moon, who also wants us to grow up and take our place in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these men have a certain age. They're in their 80s.
Yeah.
And they're leaving behind this wonderful legacy of wanting us to take our part in the cosmic cultures and in the cosmos, and not be our little silly little primitive species that are still doing the same thing we did in caveman days.
Yeah.
So I really admire these people. And what did I walk away with? The inspiration that Paul Hellyer gave me is the same one that Edgar Mitchell gives me, is the same one that Colonel Corso gave me, all in their older years. These people are becoming very, very enlightened and giving us a very solid message.
Yeah. And how do you respond to the critics of Hellyer? Now, I heard someone on the radio the other night say, well, he just read Colonel Corso's book, and that's all he has for information. I have interviewed Alfred Weber, and he told me that pretty much what you just said, that Hellyer confirmed it with U.S. sources of his own. That's correct, right? Hellyer, he didn't just get his, he didn't just read the day after Roswell, and now he's a UFO buff, right?
Do you honestly think that he would do that?
Well, some people
Well, you know, what they could, because they have something to say about everything. I wish they would go in and talk to the man. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, okay, it's really easy for you to say that. You think he's stupid being, you know, the national, the ex-minister of defense. In my interview, he said he got UFO reports coming on his desk when he was minister, ex-minister of defense. I mean, if people would bother to read my interview and stop, you know, just gossiping and would do some rare, they would see that his words, and I have it on tape because there's a DVD, he says, UFO reports were coming across my desk, but I did not have time to look into them because I was unifying the armed forces, something everybody wanted to do. But not only were they coming across his desk, you'd think he wasn't being briefed. I mean, you know, come on. I mean, you'd have to be crazy not to know that being Minister of Defense, you bet your life he knows national security issues. And when he's sitting there in front of me telling me he's extremely concerned, he is extremely concerned about this situation. It isn't just Corso's book. It's a whole bunch of situations. He's done his homework. He's listened and read the Disclosure Project. I mean, none of those military men in Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project are lying. These men put their career on line to be in Washington.
Exactly.
So this is serious business. Look, even if two military men came forth, even if two, and we have something like 50, mm-hmm. And it's ridiculous. I mean, there's so much proof in this phenomenon and so ridiculously about so much debunking that it isn't even worth talking. Paul Hellyer is really, really serious because he does not want us to go ahead and be having some kind of space war unless we know who the devil are in those spaceships.
Yeah.
And I agree with him there, you know. Mm-hmm. I agree with him there. He said that is a serious way to look at it. But then what if the space war is staged? That even gets trickier.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so are these serious policy issues? You bet. Are they serious national security issues? You bet. And they should be heralding somebody like Paul Hellyer instead of criticizing him. Because at least he came forward with it. And he's doing his homework. I mean, I'm sure he's spoken to a lot of people. He can't come forward. He can't mention names. A lot of times, even with people that I deal with, a lot of this is extremely confidential. And you just can't come out and say who told you or where this is coming from. But you know that you have firsthand sources that he's dealing with.
Yeah.
And I deal with a lot of firsthand sources too. But you have to protect their identities. And so, besides, why would he ever do this unless it was serious business? I mean, he's retired, he's 82, he's written all kinds of books. He feels that this is one of the most important, crucial issues that mankind has to face. And it's and people that really want to do their homework should look at the text on my website on exactly what he said.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I wanted to set the record straight on that because I hear it a lot that all Hellyer had was Corso's book, and now that makes him some kind of UFO expert, and that's not the case at all, and I'm glad that you had the chance to clear that up.
Yeah, but then, you know, there's another phenomenon in this in the ufology, and that is the new man on the block that everybody's jealous of, and that I hate that whole situation. I've seen it happen with Michael Sala. I've seen it happen with everybody. Instead of calling him up and saying, can we have lunch, Paul Hellyer, can we have lunch, Dr. Sala, can we talk? What they do is they just go after the jugular. They go after these people without ever bothering to find out who they are, anything about them, or why they're even in the field. For me, the ufology field is an extremely unpopular field. It isn't something you choose. It's something that you have some kind of passion about or personal curiosity about. It's not something you jump into with both feet unless you have some reason. And I think the more intelligent approach would be to pick up a phone or to read my interview with him or hear his speech, especially his speech in Hawaii. If people can actually buy that, the speech in Hawaii, they can buy the DVD of what he said in Hawaii. He talked about Ryan Wood's book. You talked about Canada. You talked about a lot of serious things.
And that's through your website, right?
No, the speech is on Michael Sala's website. He has all the DVDs of the Hawaii conference, and one of the speakers there was Phil Corso Jr., because in Hawaii, Colonel Corso's son came, and he met with Paul Hellyer and was able to give Paul Hellyer all kinds of new information that Colonel Corso revealed.
Oh, awesome, awesome. And I want to ask you for an update on the Brazilian disclosure story that broke about a year and a half ago, that the Brazilian government was going to hand over some information to A.J. Javard, and you had appeared on the radio with A.J. Javard to talk about it, and I haven't heard much about it since. What's the latest on that, and how has that developed in the year and a half since the story first started rolling?
Well, you know, AJ and I are pretty good friends because he puts out a magazine. He puts out a UFO OVNI magazine, and we put out Area 51, so we're always talking. And AJ has gotten files and gotten cooperation from officials. But, you know, the files that he got were not current. They were, you know, a couple of years old.
Yeah.
The fact that they considered him, though, worthy of working with them, and they considered a researcher worthy of being part of a dialogue with military, was what's important. So anything that AJ has printed, he's printed in Portuguese, unfortunately, in his magazine. We don't get it here in the United States. What AJ is trying to do is translate his magazine into English.
Yeah.
We only have one magazine here, and it's not on the newsstands. It's UFO magazine, so you have very little access to the newest ufological material. And AJ is trying really hard to get it translated into English so he can also let you see what his newest work is. And the fact that he's being taken seriously and working together with the military is historical.
And is there more going on there with the Brazilian disclosure? Are they giving any more information out? Have they had any talks about more stuff coming out from the Brazilian government, or is it sort of a one-shot deal?
No, it's kind of a one-shot deal. But, you know, I'm going to add something, Tim, that might interest you, though. You know Roger Lear, who is the doctor who does the implant surgeries.
Yes.
He did go down to Brazil, and he did do some research with AJ on that Virginia case. The Virginia case is so very important because that's so recent, and that he did, you know, where there was the crash and the creatures were running around the little town.
Yeah.
And seen by everybody. And Roger Lear, who was an American, see, this is an example of working together that I love, and Roger Lear is an example of an American researcher who did go down there, and he talked to the family of the fireman that picked up the creature and put him on his lap, and that later died. And this is one of the exopolitical situations that I talk about all the time. This was a real case. The creatures were running around the town. I mean, they were not grazed. They were they had a reddish skin, and the people mistake them for devils because they do not look like us, obviously. They were creatures. And the fire department went to look for the one that was free and did find him. And the young fireman, I think he was 24 years old, puts this creature on his lap and holds him. And of course, the being did not offer any resistance at all. And they take him to a hospital. Okay, that is real. That's documented. They got that. That happened. But the exopolitical part that interests me is the fact that whatever is there, the poor being, the acid on the being or whatever the being had, went and caused the death of this very young fireman. And you know, he left a family behind. And so Roger Lear, who does very good research, went down to speak to the family. And you know, that was a real case. That's a situation where if there is an alien running around or you're trying to capture him or something, you do not touch him like this young man did. I mean,
yeah.
You have to, if we had a protocol in place, if we looked at this as a real situation, that would never have happened because it would have been a protocol where you would have put up gloves or some kind of outfit or something where
yeah.
You would not have been contaminated. Now, to me, that's logical. All this stuff is logical. I don't understand why we can't talk about it and why we can't develop protocols and why people can't look at it as research.
What do you mean we? The American ufologists or ufologists?
No,
in
general, world ufology in general, because I don't think it's any different in Italy. I don't think that Italy or France has a definite protocol for any kind of contact. I mean, if you see a being that's hurt or a being from a crash or anything, I don't think we have protocols in place. And if we do, we don't know about them.
Yeah. Yeah. And like what you said about Dr. Roger Lear going down to Brazil, that's the kind of thing you encourage is a lot of international ufology. That's why I like to call you a geo-ufologist, because you cover the world here. Expound on that a little bit, how we need to unify the world of ufology. We need more American researchers, you know, going out to check out the Italian conferences, and like you brought Monsignor Balducci to America and that kind of thing. We need more of that scenario going on in ufology and not just, you know, covering it from your home office.
Exactly, and covering it, and making these ad hoc statements from your, you know, so you can be on TV. I mean, it's ridiculous. In Europe, we have brought over, in the last 5 years, we've brought over Linda Howe, we brought over Richard Boylan, we brought over John Mack, Nick Pope from England, Roger Lear, we've had Bud Hopkins. We've brought over all these people to Europe, okay, because we're trying to exchange information. I don't think we brought anybody from Europe here. I mean, the only person that gets to come, and he's among the best, is Jaime Maussan, who came to Laughlin, and A.J. Giffard, who's come to Laughlin. Aktan Hakutan from Turkey has come to Laughlin, and you know, if we do more international kind of work where people are actually looking at what's happening all over the world, they could put together the pieces better. Again, somebody like Roger Lear who goes to check on Virginia case, I guess we're going to go back to the big issue of money.
Yeah.
Nothing is sponsored, and he would have had to go on his own dime, and I think that's one of the problems. I think that a lot of the people are looking for money instead of spending money. In other words, I think in a way, you know, if it becomes too commercialized, you know, it's a way of looking for money rather than people spending their money to go and do the actual research. I wonder how many people that don't believe Roswell has happened have ever gone there to speak to the surviving witnesses. Apart from Jesse Marcel Jr., who happened to be in Denver, I mean, there's Glenn Dennis, who was the mortician during that period, who is an incredible witness. Mm-hmm. And instead of, you know, playing around with the weather balloon story, you should go and talk to these witnesses that are still alive. Most of these people are in age, and we're going to lose them. We lost Walter Hopp this year. And so I consider field research or even whatever kind of research people can do where they actually talk to the people face-to-face, not on the phone, the best kind of research. And that's why I get very frustrated when I hear these debunkers. You know, I feel like saying, how much money did you spend to go to speak to that person so you can debunk them? You know, I that's why I get so frustrated when I hear these statements being thrown out without any real, you know, research being done.
With regards to the issue of the lack of funds, how do you think ufology can even overcome that? Because that's been a problem for a very long time. It doesn't seem to have any sort of solution. I talked to Steve Bassett at length for the series last year, and he was really emphasizing the same point, that there's just such a lack of funds in ufology that it makes it so hard to really do anything. Is there any way really to overcome that sort of thing, or is it just, you know, perseverance?
No, there's no way to overcome it. All the research I do, where I fly here, there, and everywhere, it comes out of my teacher's salary. If I didn't have another job, I could never do it. There is no way to overcome it. It is not serious enough. I mean, just like Alan, you know, Alan Hynek also was looking for funding. In the last years of his life, I know we looked at all different situations for funding the Center for UFO Studies, and he made that statement about getting to the moon. If you really want to do this, I mean, apart from Black Ops, and I said it beautifully, I mean, the people that are working in the Black Ops programs that are doing all the real, you know, back engineering and finding out about the aliens and all that, that's funded. I'm not going to talk about that,
yeah.
You know, how that's done, but that's funded. If the researchers that wanted to do it on their own that wanted to study it could fund it. They have to fund it from doing some other kind of job. It's very hard, and I don't know too many people that can make a living off ufology. It just isn't possible. And if you do make a living off ufology, then something is there where you have to, like, really, you know, really be everywhere. I mean, you have to do a lot of shows and sell a lot of books and do a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think maybe if ufology gets further ensconced in academia and maybe changes the minds of whoever puts out the grants and that kind of thing, maybe then it could happen? But that's sort of a long shot in and of itself.
I don't think grants are the answer, because grants are sometimes government grants, and it's really hard to justify, you know. That's one of the reasons why a lot of these people can't tell the truth and know the truth, because they're getting government grant money. I don't think that that's the – I think it's young people. I think it's going to be the other generation. Again, I'm going to go back to the thing. The day the people want to know, the people will know. The day the younger generation says, enough of this, I want to know, I want to study, I want to put it together, that's when they'll know. Those people, those are the ones that are you know, I mean, if you look at – without going into the protest movement of during the Vietnam War, I mean, that stopped the machinery right there.
Yeah.
If enough people got together, they could stop everything. I mean, I think it has to be the younger generation. I don't know, even though I find, and this is really amazing, all conferences I do in the United States, I even spoke in Sedona, they're all the older generation. There's nobody under the age of 50 or 60 in the audience. It's almost like, you know, we always knew, but, you know, we want to know from you, because we always knew, and it's all older people. I keep asking, where are the young people? Where are the 30-year-olds? Where are the 20-year-olds? Where are the young people? I mean, don't you want to know? Aren't you curious about all this? And that is the biggest question I have to ask somebody. I mean, if I were doing an interview, that's probably, I would ask everybody that. Where are the young people that are interested in this phenomenon?
Well, let me turn that around on you and ask you, where are they, and why do you think they're not, you know, I'm 27, I'm one of the very few people in the UFO field that's, like you said, below the age of 30. Where do you think these people are? And obviously, like you said, they're not here. Where are they? Why do you think they haven't picked up the UFO issue as something worth investigating?
Because I think they're disillusioned with everything. They just kind of they shut down. It's like the disillusion with all of it. They don't expect to get a right answer with anybody. I mean, they probably they're just so disillusioned with society, the government, the world, the planet, that they don't expect probably an honest answer from anyone. So they're not even looking, which is really wrong. I mean, they should start doing scholarly study. I'm going to push that forever. They should look. But I think that's my answer. I wish you'd asked him that question from a lot of people, because that's the thing that really bothers me the most. Whenever I come to any conference, there's a lot more young people in Europe that are at conferences. I mean, I told you that group in Florence is all 30-year-olds, and they brought John Mack, Linda Howe. They brought a lot of famous people in, because they're studying, but they're a university group. So I encourage you, Tim, to ask other people, where are the young people that are interested in this?
And you said there's more young people. It seems like there's more young people in Europe. What do you think the cultural differences between Europe and America as to why there'd be more young people there than here in the United States?
Well, this is a philosophical question. When we study in Europe, we study history. We study philosophy. Philosophy is part of it. You got to study philosophy. I mean, if you look at the UFO phenomenon, this is philosophy. This is philosophy of living. It has the philosophy of cultures, of cosmic cultures. It's philosophy of beliefs. It's belief systems. It's a lot of things. Here, I think people, I may be wrong, but I think that the main educational goal in American education is money making. You know, it's success with commercial money making. Philosophy has nothing to do with it. History has nothing to do with it. I mean, MBA, and you're there, and you're gonna make your million, and that's that's the only difference that I really see. It's the philosophy, the history, and the connection is not really pushed. When I was teaching here in the States, I was teaching history, and the kids just didn't have any relevance to history. I mean, they were wondering why they had to take it. In Europe, since you're steeped in history, and that could be cosmic history too, I think there's a lot more curiosity about the nature of planet Earth, the nature of the human species, the nature of philosophy, and the nature of how we all got to where we are now. I think there's a lot more curiosity. That's just personal opinion, so I want to stress that for people. It's just my personal opinion.
What's the perspective of the people in the Italian UFO field? What's their perspective on the U.S. Ufology scene? Because the U.S. ufology scene, they're kind of like the big dog in the yard. You know, we have Roswell, and obviously the country's so big that there's even regions, you know, West Coast is a lot different from East Coast ufology. Over in Europe, what's the perspective of what's going on here? Is it like they're not doing enough, or they don't take it seriously enough, or I wish they'd do something differently, or they admire the U.S. scene? What's the perspective from Europe on the U.S. scene?
Huge secrecy. America knows the answer. They have a stake in keeping the technology secret. Area 51 is where it all happens. There's huge black ops programs that will never come out, and that's it. In other words, it's the big secret. It's here. It's the big country that's got the big secret that has the answers that aren't ever going to talk about it. And they really believe that. They believe that we're the key. That America is the key to the whole thing.
Yeah.
That it's being hidden here. It's being, apart from the fact it's being ridiculed, we're not even going to that, but the big secret is the secret here. I mean, it's not hard because they don't give very much cooperation. I mean, we're not having world forums on ufology. We're not having a San Marino, has every flag of the world and one ufologist from all over the world there. It's a serious situation like the United Nations. I don't see anything like that happening here.
Yeah, and is there like a resentment in a sense? Is it sort of like, well, we have to work around the U.S. scene because they're not playing with the rest of us as far as ufology goes? And I don't mean like the U.S. government, but I just mean like the U.S. researchers.
Well, I think they like the researchers. I mean, we brought over so many of the researchers. The researchers are like heroes to the Europeans. All these researchers that are doing such a good job are like heroes. Now, they look at, what it is a fallacy. They're looking at the United States government as having a secret. Well, we just talked about this. Stephen Greer had to brief half of the people in Washington that he dealt with. They don't know. They don't know. They don't have time to know. They don't want to get into it. They got other things on their plate. The UFO secret is not in Congress or in the presidency or, you know, that's not where it's at. But the world in general doesn't know that. They blame the government. I remember Colonel Corso saying to me, Paula, don't mention the government. What's the government? It's changed over the last 20 years. It's not even the same people. So you're blaming people that have changed roles. He said it's not the government that's keeping the secret. But that's the fallacy. I mean, that's all the Europeans think it's the government, the president knows, and all that. And that's not the case. That's not the way it is.
Yeah. Okay, and another story and person I want to talk to you about for a little update was Charles Hall. You did a lot of work with him at the beginning of 2005. I haven't heard much from Charles in the last year or so. I'm sure you're probably more up to date on what's going on with his story. Have there been any advances in the Charles Hall story?
Well, I haven't heard much from him either, so I'm going to be honest with you. That was a very hard case to deal with because the communications there didn't go all that well. I mean, that's what happens sometimes with the cases. I was the journalist that brought that out because I researched that really well and found the other people that worked with Charles on the Indian Springs base. After 40 years, the only way we could do that was by contacting the a retired LA police captain who actually found the people that Charles were mentioning in his book. So the fact that that case came out, the fact that people, if they're interested in it, can look for the Millennium Hospitality books. I will also mention him, and I am writing a brand new book called How does one speak to a ball of light? Exopolitical implications for future contact. I will mention part of the Charles Hall case in that book because that is a real case of galactic diplomacy and citizen diplomacy. Here's a man who's a meteorologist out on the Indian Springs base who has not been told that there are tall white aliens with their kids walking around, floating around in that case in the 1960s, 1965. He has not been told that, and he has this encounter with them without any preparation and not knowing how to handle himself and not knowing how to communicate and being scared out of his wits. The way Charles, communicated with those aliens is perfect for the point I want to make about not being prepared. Here's Charles who sees what he thinks is an animal in a sagebrush, you know, in the sage, and he gets closer and he sees it's a little girl with transparent blonde hair, and realizes when looking at the eyes that they're almond-shaped and blue that it's not human, or that child is not a human child. And he has to, his data bank and his whole system, his whole nervous system, everything has to change over to try to accept that what he's looking at is different from what he's used to. That case is important. I encourage people to look at that case. And I believe his story. I mean, if I didn't fly him out there with my partner, David Coot, we did this story together. He's an airline pilot who worked on the story with me. I flew Charles Hall out to Indian Springs, close to the base, and we're able to, he was able to tell us, you know, detail by detail, how his encounter was in 65. If I hadn't done field research, and I would never really understood that story. And I think that that story is part of the overall research I've done to show that contact has already happened, that there needs to be protocol, there needs to be some ideas of how to deal with this on a serious level for the future. So thanks for mentioning it, and I really think that the people that are interested in the Charles Hall case should read Millennial Hospitality.
Definitely. I wanted to ask you, I ask a lot of people who've been on the show, I wanted to ask you if you've been following the Serpo story at all and what you think of it as it's unfolded so far.
Well, you know, I follow everything. We did cover the Serpo story in Area 51. I mean, I can't throw everything away. I think that, first of all, I think there's a core truth, a little tiny seed truth to this story. I think that it's probably 60% disinformation and 40% information. And that's the way every story that comes out is part of the slow process release of information comes out. It comes out with all this disinformation around it so that we get something called official deniability. So people can say, oh, yeah, well, you know, this isn't really true. But a core of it is true. The thing that interests me about that is that it's the same scenario of Close Encounters. And I know that Close Encounters, after all this time, a lot of it was true.
Yeah.
So it is not unusual that there may be a meeting, that there may be a landing, and that there may be an exchange. Now, I don't think it's exactly the way it's being depicted at Serpo, the Serpo situation, because there's nobody alive from that group to be able to verify it. So that would be very poor research. I mean, if there's nobody alive, I mean, who are you going to interview?
Yeah.
But I think it's an attempt to talk to us about the fact that it could be logical that an exchange was made.
Yeah.
And I've heard other exchange stories. I can't go into them in detail.
Yeah.
But I have heard other exchange stories from viable sources in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And not always American, not always an American exchange.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What other countries, if you don't mind me asking?
it's better if I don't go into the details of that because I've heard that a lot of other countries have been contacted other than America. And as far as, and it started way back during the German times, before, right around that time. What's curious is that, right now, whatever is contacting us is going to the biggest, the most powerful country on earth. If for some reason, America doesn't become the most powerful country on Earth, whatever is contacting the planet is going to go to the next country.
Yeah.
And we're going to all make guesses where that country is going to be.
Well, actually, that kind of segues a little bit into something I wanted to ask you. Is being that you know of a lot of stuff that's going on around the world as far as ufology goes, do you hear a lot coming out of the Asian countries right now, most notably China? They're very closed door, but also they have a pretty serious ufology scene. Do you ever hear much coming out of there? And also the English-speaking Hong Kong area might also be a place where you might be hearing some stuff.
Well, I just know about their sightings because I met Shun Chi Lee in Laughlin, and he is the Chinese representative. See, this is what would be so cool if we could have him speak, because he represents China and the Chinese ufology, and there's quite a few sightings there. What I've heard the most, though, you said Asian, Japan is everywhere. Japanese television is literally everywhere. They covered the Billy Myers story, and they in the Nippon group bought Billy Myers' movies, and they've got an incredible presentation on Meyer. They did incredible research. They have been covering the crop circle phenomenon, the Japanese. They were in Phoenix for the Phoenix Lights. I mean, the Japanese film crews are everywhere, and a lot of the outtake NASA footage is coming out of Japan, too. A lot of the footage that shows anomalous objects that are not all ice particles, I mean, that's impossible, that are in space, they're coming out of Japan. So if somebody had to ask me where the avant-garde video, interviewing, media is coming out of, I would say Japan. For some reason, they're really interested, and their camera crews are everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, you invest a lot of your own money in your research. How do you decide as a researcher which stories to go after, which cases to investigate? Do you have to do an extensive amount of sort of like weeding them out? Because like you said, you fly out and talk to the people. I mean, you couldn't do that for every case, and I mean, you wouldn't want to get into a situation where you're flying out to meet some person that you don't think is telling the truth, but maybe that's happened before, I don't know. But as a researcher, how do you determine what's worthy of further investigation?
Well, actually, I'm kind of in a narrow field. It's narrow in that a lot of the people that are my original stories are military or intelligence people. The Charles Hall story, he's ex-military.
Yeah.
And Carl Corso's military. Michael Wolf Cuvant was intelligence community. Clifford Stone is military. So I stay in that field, and maybe I should branch out a little bit. So usually, Clark McClellan, with whom I'm still communicating, is ex-NASA, worked on the Apollo programs, worked in NASA for 22 years. I'm more in that field with these people that are sharing information. So, if they can show me credentials that they are, who they say they are, and if they have a story, I usually decide after I fly out and meet them. And with my latest one was Paul Hellyer. I mean, you can't go wrong. That's ex-Minister of Defense.
Yeah.
you can't go wrong with someone like him. And I just did an interview with Robert Salas. I had mentioned Robert Salas again. He'd be a great interview for you. He is the retired military gentleman who was in the bunker when the missiles were shut down in Maelstrom. I mean, these are viable people that I interview. Now, there have been one or two cases that I would like to do. For instance, I have met, and I do believe the story of Helen Kittel, who says that a hybrid alien girl was her daughter's roommate.
Okay, yeah.
Some
yeah.
years ago. I do believe that the name of that book is Rachel's Eyes, but that was investigated by a MUFON investigator, and I think it's Jean Bilodeau, and that's already been investigated. But I would recommend that people read Rachel's Eyes, because that's another case of aliens and humans mixing on Earth. It's just like the Charles Hull case. If I had the time and energy and I wasn't, you know, going back to Italy, that's a case that I would look into a little bit deeper, because I have talked to her several times on the phone and then in person. And I really think that that would be an incredible case to follow up on.
That sort of segues well into what kind of present-day cases are you working on or you see coming up on the horizon as far as your investigations go?
Well, more than present-day cases, I think that I'm really excited about teaching the course in exopolitics that Michael Sala is doing, so I can do, you know, put together some more information on my own. But I am going to look heavily again into the Charles Hull case as far as using pieces of that for my book. And also I would like to, you know, talk more with A.J. Gebhardt of the Virginia case. Now, I already have checked into this. I wanted to go to Mexico and talk to the young boys who were involved, I don't know if you know, in the cellular phone case where the alien grabbed the boy while they were playing soccer in Mérida in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. I've heard
it,
about it.
You know, you probably know about that case. It was all captured on cell phone. And I've been working with Santiago Ituria to see if I can get to Mexico to interview those boys myself. Because, I mean, I saw the film footage. I mean, that there's nothing hoaxed there. Basically, also, the fact that there is radiation in that spot, and Jaime Maussan has invited people to go there and use whatever methods to examine the radiation that the universities have found there in that particular spot. I'm interested in that because that's real scientific evidence. So that case I'm really interested in. Plus, I've never seen any of the crop circles, and I would love to go to England next year and do more crop circle research, even though I'm convinced a lot of them are imitations. I believe there are some real ones. We had one in Italy that I'd like to look into. So I might branch into looking at and questioning the crop circle phenomenon in England. So I guess, in a way, I should broaden what I do into these areas. I think it probably would produce a lot of growth for me.
Like you say, connecting the dots, pretty much it all comes down to that, really. You're a very prolific speaker. You make a lot of appearances. What's your schedule like for conference appearances and speaking appearances upcoming?
Okay, I have a lot of them in Europe. Basically, I will be speaking in England on two occasions. I am going to England on the 24th. I'm speaking on the 30th, and I've got two speaking engagements in England. Then I will be coming back, and I will be speaking in Venice in northern Italy, and then I will be speaking at Florence. That young group of people is putting on a conference, and Ryan Wood will be there. Then I am putting on a conference in Rome on the 29th of October, inviting Russell Targ, Stanford Research Institute. He's a physicist that's also very mystical and has written Miracles of the Mind, and I would like him to do some remote viewing demonstrations in Rome because he worked at Stanford Research Institute. So I put on conferences. I'm doing that one, and then I will be doing one in France, in Marseille, in France. And so I have a set of conferences in Europe that I do, and I will be flying back at Christmas time here and hope to attend Laughlin. I mean, I won't be speaking there, but I'll meet a lot of people from all over the world there. And I'm looking forward to doing that. And one last thing I wanted to tell you, Tim, is that I was really, really impressed with Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, okay? And I just wrote a major article that's going to be published, I think, everywhere, comparing the fact that we are up for ecological disaster that could possibly be helped not only by our energy saving, but also by the disclosure of new technologies that are being hidden. And I attended Stephen Greer's lecture here at the university, and he's on the same wavelength about these new technologies that could possibly save the planet. Technologies we've had for a long time that do not require fossil fuel. And I just attended a lecture, a book signing actually by Al Gore, and took photos of him and thanked him very much for his commitment. We need people that have that kind of commitment with real information to come forth, because this is also a manner of ecological saving of the planet.
Yeah. And you spoke about the new book. When do you expect the new book to be available for the listeners?
Well, the manuscript will be submitted in January, and How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light, Exopolitical Implications for Future Contact will be coming out, I'm hoping, at Roswell in July of next year, 2007, because it's going to be the 60th anniversary. My first book came out in Roswell, and I'm hoping that it'll be there, that I'll release it and you know, with all my colleagues, be able to give another little bit of something to the world, as far as giving them my research that I've been doing, so they can put together the whole entire picture.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, I can't wait for the new book to come out. The book, your present book, is called Connecting the Dots, and that's available pretty much everywhere, right? Amazon and Barnes
Amazon,
and Noble,
yeah.
And all that stuff. The website is paulaharris.it, and let me spell that out for you. It's paulaharris.it. That's the website, and you can find out tons more information there, I'm sure, correct?
Yes, and I also have a new one that's coming out. It's Paula Harris at exopolitics.com. So that will be only exopolitics on papers. It'll be papers on exopolitics and thesis statements and so forth, dealing with just exopolitics.
Oh, wow. What's the address for that again?
Paula Harris at exopolitics.com.
Okay, all one word?
All one word.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, Paula, I really want to thank you for being on the show. Like I said, you opened the door for me to talk to Monsignor Balducci, and you were just amazingly kind and generous and welcoming to me as a newcomer to the field and as a young person in the field. It's very intimidating when you first get into it, and you were just so welcoming and friendly and nice and great to talk to you at the X Conference. And I'm just so glad we finally got a chance to sit down and talk at length and have you on the show and bring your amazing research out to the listeners of Binaural of America Audio, who have been asking for you to be on the show for quite some time. They're going to be very excited when they hear the interview. Like I said, I owe you a huge debt of gratitude. A lot of what you do is what I do, and that's talk to the big names in ufology and some of the lesser-known people and all the great researchers and try and tie it all together. I definitely patterned a lot of my work after your work because I admire your style so much. It's just been great to have you on the show, and hopefully this is just the beginning of more adventures for you and me in the UFO field.
Thanks a lot, Tim. I'm so thrilled that you're in this field, and I have high hopes that more young people will get involved, because it's the most important question for our species and for the planet.
That does it for the Paula Harris portion of this expanded edition of Binaural of America Audio. Big, big, super huge thanks to Paula Harris for coming on the show, sitting down with us, giving us so much time and insight, and really I think we just barely scratched the surface of discussing the UFO phenomenon. If you want more information on Paula Harris, check out paulaharris.it. Let me spell that for you. www.paulaharris.it. And now, let's just roll right into the debut of Binaural of America Audio Listener Feedback.
DeVale! DeVale is here!
Yes, the little fancy music is a sign that it is time for the debut of the Binaural of America Audio Listener Feedback portion of the show, with an email from Richard in Swansea, Wales, UK. I've corresponded with Richard before. He's a great guy, so let's rock it out with his letter here. Will you be doing any reporting on the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference you're going to? I'm interested in what Richard Dolan has to say about his new book. I'm about halfway into Volume 1 and looking forward to reading the second volume. Also, I enjoyed your latest show. The idea that the chupacabra is some kind of insect was interesting, and I think maybe the more likely. I know the show is called Been All of America, but it's nice that you have people on the show talking about what is going on in other countries. It proves that UFOs are not just some kind of Anglo-American cultural thing. Keep up the good work and have fun at the conference. All the best, Richard in Swansea, Wales, UK. Well, thank you very much for the letter, Richard. Yes, I will be doing some reporting on the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. I expect to have a full report filed at beenallofamerica.com probably on the Tuesday following the conference. So stop by beenallofamerica.com for that. And also, I will be bringing my trusty recorder with me, not the musical instrument, but the interview recorder. And I will be talking to some of the people who will be speaking at the conference. I've looked over the speaker list, and I'm putting together questions for just about everybody who is going to be there as a speaker. And depending on who will sit down and talk to me and who has time, those will be the interviews we can get. So hopefully I'm aiming at maybe at worst 5, at best 10. So somewhere in there, expect that number of interviews. How we decide to release them is undetermined at this point, depending on how long they go. Like I said, we don't know exactly how many interviews we'll have. If it's a ton of time, we may do a little spin-off series, kind of like the X-Conference sessions, or if it's, you know, manageable, if it's like 3 hours or 4 hours, maybe it'll be spread out over the course of a couple weeks' worth of episodes of Been All of America Audio Season 2. I haven't really decided that sort of thing, but I would expect the interviews to be airing sometime at beenallofamerica.com around the end of December, January time period, roughly. Regarding Richard Dolan, yes, I will be sure to find out any information going on about the release of the second volume of his book. What I heard was that it would be released in time for the conference, available at the conference, or something like that. So I'll find out the full scoop on the Richard Dolan, UFOs in the National Security State, Volume 2 book, and that'll be included in the report at beenallofamerica.com. Regarding the international nature of Been All of America's podcast series, yes, I really appreciate you that you point that out. We strive to get as many different voices from around the world on Been All of America Audio. We're in talks with people from various other countries to appear on the show in the near future. You just heard a lengthy interview with Paula Harris where we discussed the European ufology scene. Last week with Scott Corrales talking about the Latin American ufology scene. We had Peter Robbins on last year. He's done a lot of touring in Japan. He had a lot to say about the Japanese ufology scene. We're going to try and delve into tying together the international strands of ufology here on Been All of America Audio. That pretty much covers all the points here from Richard's question. Richard, in Swansea, Wales, UK, thank you very much for writing. If you want your letter to be read on a future edition of Been All of America Audio Listener Feedback, simply send your email to boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to beenallofamerica.com and click the contact button. It's in the top right-hand corner of the screen. That will put you on the road to getting your letter read on Been All of America Audio Listener Feedback. Moving right along, I want to thank the fine folks at beenallofamerica.com for your help and support with the audio series and the website. I'm talking about Chiron, Leslie, R. Lee, Joe V., Ralph Molesworth. Much of what you hear and see at beenallofamerica.com would not be possible without the help and support of these fine folks. Check out their columns at beenallofamerica.com. Check out their affiliated websites. The Debris Field, and that's thedebrisfield.blogspot.com, Chiron.net, K-H-Y-R-O-N.net, and ufobits.blogspot.com. Those are the affiliated websites of the fine folks who write for beenallofamerica.com. Check out their websites. And, of course, don't forget beenallofamerica.com. Make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. If you're a long-time Been All of America audio listener or an appreciative newcomer and you want to help support the audio series, click the PayPal button at beenallofamerica.com. Make a donation, and help pay the bills here at Been All of America Audio. Up next now, as we close out here the expanded edition of Been All of America Audio, it is an excerpt from the May 27th, 2006 edition of Been All of America Audio Season 1 with our guest Ryan Wood. Ryan and his father Robert Wood are the brains behind the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. You can find out more information at www.ufoconference.com. That's November 10th to the 12th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Be there or be square. And here in this excerpt from our interview with Ryan Wood from last year, we discuss what the goals are for the conference, how it started, who will be speaking at the conference next weekend, and some of the topics they're going to be talking about. This should give you some insight into what will be going on in Las Vegas next weekend when Banal of America Audio is not on the air. Here is Ryan Wood previewing the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4.
The UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. This is you and your dad put this on. How did it come about? How has it evolved? What's it like running your own conference? Tell me about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. Before you do, I've heard just amazingly good things about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, and I'm not kissing your butt here. This is the truth, because everybody I talk to who's gone always says it's awesome. All the people who are on the show who speak there always tell me, you got to check out the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. Sounds like the place to be as far as conferences goes. It's one of the best of the conferences out there that I've heard of. So tell me about it. How did it come about? Like I said, how has it evolved? Yeah. You know, what's it like running it?
Well, it sort of evolved because I became personally disgusted with going to the other conferences and getting a cross section of goo. You know, a couple of talks were great, and the rest of it was just like, oh my God, how in the world did they ever let this guy on the stage? And so I said, hey, I'm just going to make my own conference, and I'm going to focus on what I consider the core thing, and that is the crash retrievals. And so that's what I decided to do, and we're coming up here on the fourth one, November 10th through 12th, in 06 at the Tuscany in Las Vegas. And we should have 300-400 people there. We've got a pretty good lineup this year. We typically have at least four, sometimes as many as six different crash retrievals that are talked about just by one speaker and then some other aspects. This year we got Stan Friedman talking about you know, why UFOs crash. Michael Sala is going to give an overview of crashed UFO black operations. We typically have a speaker panel and press conference on Friday night, and everybody gives a little five-minute summary. Rich Dolan will be there and have part two of his you know, two-volume set, UFOs in the National Security State from 1973 to 2006. He's working hot and heavy on that right now, and yep. By the fall we'll have it done. Paul Shatskin, who's done a couple of biographies, and he's working on T-Towns and Brown, a famous sort of anti-gravity, electrogravitics person, and I'm going to have him talking about the linkages of him to the UFO field and to the government and so forth. I typically have one sort of in-depth biography of an interesting person that was either murdered by MJ-12 or relevant to this process. Mm-hmm. I'm giving a talk on a brand new crash retrieval that's not in my book. It's one of the new 11 that I've got, and I hope to have some real breathtaking info about that. I mean, it's a good story right now, but with a little more research, I may have hardware.
Awesome.
So that should light people up. And then Michael Lindemann, who's talking about scenarios of contact. He's been a facilitator of when he worked for Joe Firmage, of a group of 20 people or so that went over a couple of weekends that talked about scenarios of contact, and he'll be reporting the results of that high-level investigation. They had a lot of military generals and scientists, and it was a very interesting event, and why they're contacting or what the implications of contact are, in an open society, I think is an important discussion.
Yeah.
And then I'm still working on a keynote speech, trying to get some people. My dad and Nick Redfern are going to be talking about crashed UFOs and biowarfare. My dad is finishing up his first book on alien viruses.
Oh, boy.
And that should be very interesting. Frank Fascino is going to talk about the Braxton County Monster. He's completely redone his book. He was had a disappointing experience with his publisher, and they hacked through a bunch of it and screwed it all up. And,
oh, man.
So he's redone it and made it a much more scholarly, stronger book.
Awesome.
Linda Howe will be back to give an update on her 53 and some other crash disk informants and so forth. I got Bruce McAbee to come talk about the El Indio Guerrero December 6, 1950 UFO crash, and I'm helping him with that, getting some more data, new data people haven't seen. Matthew Thuney is going to talk about the Lumini Island incident off of sort of an underwater Roswell event. Here's a new one. Peter Merlin.
Oh.
His talks after the fire, how the government responds to top secret crashes.
Oh,
he is basically a crashed airplane expert.
Yeah.
He's been to hundreds of crashes, including stealth fighter that crashed outside Bakersfield, and he's giving a talk on sort of what they do and how they respond when something important crashes. How's the site sanitized? Did they remove every trace?
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. He's an aerospace archaeologist. And so it should be very interesting because he's, you know, he's not in the UFO field per se, but he's bringing an important skill dimension to this topic.
Yeah.
And so that's the cross section of our conference, and UFOconference.com has all the data. And if you go to the website, you can register online or fax it in and see the.
Yeah, and that's UFOconference.com.
Yeah, UFOconference.com.
And with that, we wrap up the special expanded edition of Benal of America Audio. Big thanks to Paula Harris, Ryan Wood, Richard in Swansea, Wales, UK, Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Ralph Molesworth of BenalofAmerica.com. And, of course, all the great listeners we have out there the world over. As I said, no audio next week. We return in 2 weeks with Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center. There'll be a preview at BenalofAmerica.com sometime in the next 2 weeks. Until you hear from me then, this is Tim Benal, thanking you for listening and signing off.